Good evening. We're going to get started. My name is Karen Seidman. I work as a contractor with the County Board of Health, and my area of specialty is functional needs. The goal, as it has been with all the other sessions that we've had, is to plan and operate emergency shelters and points of dispensing in Northeast Ohio responsive to the needs of all community members. We hope at the end of this program, attendees will be able to identify at least two concerns for shelter residents who are treated with hemodialysis. And at the end of this program, they will also be able to develop a plan to address these concerns. Okay, I'm going to let our presenters introduce themselves.
Okay. Yes, go ahead.
Well, good evening, and thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Tracy Douglas, and I am the Executive Director of Clinical Operations at the Centers for Dialysis Care, and I have with me Jamie Stanos, the Chief Operating Officer, also at the Centers for Dialysis Care. And what we want to talk to you tonight is really what happens in the event there's either a local emergency, and we've seen some of those instances with the blackouts, with the most recent events of Hurricane Sandy. And what happens if there's a global situation? And while we really have not, or a more broad spectrum, larger disaster, which we haven't really seen in Ohio, but we certainly have seen in other parts of the country, again with Hurricane Sandy where it wiped out dialysis units, Hurricane Katrina was a very good example of a widespread issue where many people were affected. So what we're going to go through tonight is just what dialysis is, how to recognize patients, what are some community resources available to you if you should be in a shelter or working to support the dialysis patient, some things you could look for, and we're really, it's a very informal presentation, and we will answer any questions, and at the end we'll share some of our experiences with some of these situations, because we were both around for the blackouts, and I worked in a national company where we actually we both did, where we had to make some plans or ban some calls of planning for things like Hurricane Katrina and obviously Sandy. Okay. Dialysis is the process of cleaning waste and extra fluid from the blood artificially. And I think in our next slide we talk about the function of the kidney. But every person has two kidneys. Every person needs those kidneys to filter out waste. For the majority of the people, most of us sitting in this room, probably our kidneys are functioning normal. We eat, we drink, we do what we need, and at the end of that we urinate and we get rid of waste. It gets rid of fluid and waste particles. What happens in a certain population of people, especially people with high blood pressure, with diabetes, with some congenital disorders, trauma, someone who is in a car accident that may have lost kidneys or had other issues, a reaction to a medication, is that their kidneys may start to fail. Now, most people can survive with about 5% of their kidney function and still lead a very normal life. However, in many patients, or some patients, their kidneys totally shut down, which means they are not making urine, they are not excreting waste, and we as providers have to come up with some kind of a therapy that excretes that waste for them. And we can actually do that in a process called dialysis. There are two types of dialysis. There are two major types of dialysis. There's hemodialysis, where we actually take the blood out of the body in a little what we call an access, which is a large vein in the arm, or a catheter, which is an external source from the neck. Those patients have to come into the dialysis unit 3 times a week, and their treatment is anywhere from 3 to 5 hours. And I think, sir, we're actually someone who is specially trained, on the job training with a special orientation and coursework, and then sits for a test and is certified by the Ohio Board of Nursing to provide that care for the patient. So, and they are always overseen by an RN in the unit. So if you have, say, 15 patients, you may have 4 patient care techs that are actually putting the patients on, monitoring the machine, taking the patients off, and then you have 1 RN that's overseeing their care. So the other kind is peritoneal dialysis. And peritoneal dialysis actually uses the peritoneum or the lining inside the belly as what we call a membrane. So it's able through osmosis and diffusion to actually pull fluid off and excrete waste that way. The advantages of peritoneal dialysis is you can do it at home. So people are much more independent. They have their supplies with them usually, so they're going to have better access to their supplies unless their house is destroyed or ruined. They are going to do their dialysis every day, for little bits every day, as opposed to a chunk of time 3 times a week. They are only seen in the clinics once a month, once every 6 weeks, so there's much more freedom. A lot of people that work and want more say in their care do peritoneal dialysis. I talked about it's done on a machine using an external kidney. Like we said, this is performed about 3 times a week. And we'll talk a little bit as we go on in the presentation about what kind of things that we may need to supply or support for a peritoneal dialysis patient. I talked a lot about the conditions that cause dialysis. Again, high blood pressure, genetic conditions. We talked a little bit about the way, why the kidneys need to remove toxins from the body. Talked about the artificial access. And the artificial access, and that's where I talked about the in the arm, the vein in the arm, which is internal, or the external catheter in the chest. And I will tell you, we'll talk a little bit when we get to what you need to do. There is a lot of importance of recognizing that, and we should have brought pictures.
Yeah, we don't have.
We don't have
any pictures.
Yes, so, but that would have been very helpful.
Although
so
if you,
yeah.
we can
get those.
Website, you can see the dialysis.
Yeah, we can get those to you, and you can send them out to everyone. But people that have this excess in their neck have a much higher potential for infection. So it's very important that that area is kept clean. Where the people that have the access in their arm, that's just, it almost looks like a huge vein. It's completely covered. It's much safer from an infection control standpoint.
Right. With an internal access, we use needles to take the blood from the patient's body. With a catheter, we connect the dialysis machine to the external catheter. So based on that alone, the risk for infection with somebody with a catheter is much greater than it is with somebody with an internal access that we use needles to access the blood.
What happens when a patient misses dialysis? And we do, keep in mind, these are people that are going to come to us. Let's talk about, in either situation, both peritoneal or hemo, it is a full-time commitment. They either have to have it every day with the peritoneal or 3 times a week. They don't get vacation days. They don't get holidays. They don't get a time when they can walk away. If they don't have the dialysis or if they go several days without dialysis, they're going to start feeling really bad. The first thing that they're going to have is, because remember, the function of dialysis is to pull out fluids and pull out waste. So they're going to get short of breath. They're going to look swollen. Their arms are going to be swollen, hands are swollen, especially around their ankles. You'll see where they look. They just look kind of puffy and swollen. You're going to be able to see that. They're going to labor with their breathing. They're going to have a hard time breathing, maybe not even speak complete sentences because they're so short of breath. Some things that you won't see is that their potassium is going to go up. You won't have any way of knowing that because it's a blood test, but it's very important because once their potassium goes up, they can start having chest pain and irregular heartbeat, and that can lead to sudden death. They could be nauseated, vomiting, and they could get confused because of all of these waste products that are building. And each person, if each one of us in this room went on dialysis and we each missed a treatment, we would see slightly different symptoms. None of us would have the exact same symptoms. So there's not a stereotypical classic pattern that a patient's going to walk in and you're going to say, oh, that's a dialysis patient, because they have this, this, and this. So
we cover some of that on the next slide also. I mean, dialysis patients are, they're not easily identifiable as a dialysis patient. So I could be on dialysis and you wouldn't know it, mm-hmm. you know. So that's why it's important to know and understand the signs and symptoms of somebody that's missing their dialysis treatments. And questions ask those individuals in a situation where, for example, in Katrina or Hurricane Sandy or whatever, in any kind of situation where patients are funneled to some kind of shelter that's outside their normal process, those questions have to be asked to identify those people who are dialysis patients, which we'll cover in a little bit.
Identifying a dialysis patient. They're going to look like you and I. Some people do have medic alert tags, so you can see it on there, or they'll have a tag, you know, that'll let you know. Some don't. The best way is just to ask, you know, in your medical, what are your medical conditions? And most patients will tell you right up, I'm a dialysis patient, truly. That's one of the first things they will talk about, because even if they have a pattern of missing and choosing not to go or skipping treatment, they still know it's important and they'll worry about where they're going to get a treatment at some point. So it usually is pretty easy information to get out of patients. The first thing we talked about, make sure the patient's access site is clean. So if the big vein in the arm, you want to make sure that's clean, soap and water. Any antibacterial soap and water. You want to make sure the access in the neck around it is clean. If it's got a bandage that's non-soiled, you want to leave that on. If it's got a bandage that is soiled or bloody or dirty, if they're in or wet because they've been in a flood, you want to get that off, wipe around it with soap and water, and get a clean bandage on that. Dialysis patients, you want to encourage them to watch their fluid intake, because anything that they take in, it can't come out. And so when you're offering, oh, do you want tea, do you want coffee, do you want water, you want to watch their fluid intake. You also want to talk to them. Dialysis patients all have a very specialized diet. Like the majority of people, or a lot of us, we are not always compliant with diet. That sometimes can be a struggle for many people in this country, but they kind of know what some of their high trouble foods are, and it's anything with potassium. That would be orange juice, tomatoes, anything that would be a high potassium food, and anything with high phosphorus. So that's nuts, cheese, soda pop, milk. Milk can be a very high phosphorus food. So just kind of ask them if they remember any dietary restrictions. And again, if it's a choice of having nothing or having one of these things, of course you're going to give them these things. It's not going to kill them. It's just something that if there's other choices, you certainly want to look at that.
In times of disaster, oftentimes the easiest things to grasp hold of relative to you know, food and water kind of thing is typically water and something that you can get your hands on quickly, like bananas. So dialysis patients can't have an overabundance of those things. And so in case of, you know, Hurricane Katrina or Sandy or something like that, where, you know, you've got groups of people in one common area where, you know, like as Tracy has suggested, you know, keeping dialysis access is clean is important, and then ensuring that we identify those group of patients that would be dialysis patients that can't continue to have overabundant amounts of water and bananas and things like that. So you'd want to know who those patients are so that if you had the opportunity to, or there were other things available for them, that you could provide that for those patients.
And, you know, in times of disaster like Katrina, I can assure you that we as a dialysis provider, and it doesn't matter what company we're working for, whether we're Fresenius or DaVita or U.S. Renal or ARA or CDC, we are going to find those patients. That becomes our primary goal, and a huge part of our disaster recovery is looking for those patients. And we have lists and emergency contact numbers, and those things are stored both in hard copy and in electronic form so that when a disaster happens, until every name on that list is checked off, so we will call your shelter. Have you seen anyone looking like this? Do you have anyone with the name of Jane Smith, because she's a dialysis patient we are looking for? So it's not all upon you to find them a dialysis center. We will find them. We will find those patients because everybody in the industry realizes how important this treatment is. And we kind of laugh because we're all competitors until a disaster happens, and then we're all here for the patients. You know, if a patient that normally dialyzes down the street at our competitor comes to our unit because we're the only one open, we will have a physician there. We will treat them. We will take care of them. And the same with our competition. There are no competitors when it comes to a disaster. And the companies that are national saw that in Hurricane Katrina. I mean, there were maybe three clinics open. They tried to geographically station them, and then every patient in the area went to one of those clinics. And you didn't care. You didn't care if it was a Fresenius patient or a DaVita patient. They were all treated. So that is the nice thing about the industry. Even though we're fiercely competitive in normal times, in times of trouble, we really do make sure that we're here for the good of the patient. The Renal Network is an entity that can be very helpful to you. So if you've seen a patient that says, oh, I'm a dialysis patient, you haven't heard from anyone, you can't find a dialysis unit that's open, the Renal Network, and we put the number at the end, they are a resource that can help support that. And what is the Renal Network? The Renal Network is a nonprofit organization that really looks out for the needs and the well-being and the rights of the dialysis patients throughout the country. So every state is going to have a renal network that they report data up to and that supports the patient. And again, they are very non-biased in, there's not a company affiliation. They are a third entity, a nonprofit data gathering organization.
And the Renal Network keeps track of, there's you know, we're networks 4, 9, and 10. You know, they number them, and they're basically states that are grouped together in terms of a particular network. That Renal Network keeps track of all the dialysis patients. So in times of a disaster, let's say we identify a group of people as dialysis patients, we don't have any other contingency plan but to call the Renal Network. If you call them, that's who we use as a resource also as a dialysis company in times of a disaster, so we can locate where all of our patients are, make sure those patients are getting the dialysis that's needed.
Internally, every company and every dialysis unit will have a disaster plan. And as part of that disaster plan, we do a lot of education with patients. So we educate patients because in Ohio, we have a lot of snow. And last year, 2 years ago, not in Ohio. I covered units at another company in Indiana and Chicago, Illinois. And for the first time in my dialysis career, we actually closed down dialysis units because of snow in Indiana and Illinois, because they got that huge dumping of snow, which then froze. So emergency vehicles, the highways were completely closed. So we had our units closed for 24 hours. And so we knew how to handle that and make contingency plans by opening them on a Sunday and figuring out how we were going to do that so the patients got the treatment they needed. And every company does that. But in those cases, the dialysis patient should have a special 3-day meal plan that they get from their dietitian. Now, if you ask any dialysis patient if they remember that, they're going to tell you no. Do they have the things that they need for that? Probably not. but they do get that education. So they're going to know what to stay away from and what they should be eating and what they should be having. We also instruct them to watch the fluids. There's a 7-day week. If dialysis patients get it 3 times a week, that means they either get it Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, or Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. So for both of those groups of patients, there's a 2-day period in there where they haven't gotten dialysis. So at the end of that 2-day period, they're going to start feeling kind of sluggish. So on a Monday or a Tuesday in our industry, our patients are a little bit sicker than they are Wednesday through Saturday. So they are going to, we instruct them on the weekends, watch your fluid intake. Don't keep it reasonable so you don't start feeling that short of breath and you don't start feeling badly. Each patient has an emergency number for their clinic. At CDC's, ours happens to be the help desk. So they will have a number that they can call in, and that number, provided it's not part of the global outage, will then let them know, oh, the patient's from Unit A, your unit is down, it doesn't have electricity, it doesn't have water, for whatever reason, you're going to report to this location to get dialysis. So each company has an internal plan like that. Where that becomes difficult, again, is in a Hurricane Katrina, where that wipes out probably 6 or 7 dialysis units, so their internal plan to go just to their unit possibly didn't work because there was just too much, it was too broad of damage. We also review the emergency takeoff and a comprehensive disaster plan with patients annually. We usually do that in the fall because, again, in Ohio, what we see more often is the snow and people missing because of snow and weather damage, more so than hurricanes or tornadoes. I know when I worked for a national company, tornado season, when they had the tornadoes in the Midwest, that was when they reviewed right before that season started. And like I said, internally, each provider will have identified a backup to meet patient needs. A lot of times what we'll tell patients, if you really feel poorly, go to the hospital. Well, I mean, we have a unit that has 350 patients, so there is no way all of our hospitals in the area can provide care for 350 patients. So we're going to have to, as an industry, get a couple of those freestanding units up and going. Because the hospitals just can't do it. They could dialyze round the clock 7 days a week and still not keep up with the need. So we do internally have a plan, and we work together in times of crisis. Local emergency rooms, again, that is one of the places that we will send people if someone is in obvious distress, having chest pain, short of breath, having trouble talking. You want to get them out and get them seen by a medical professional. Our Kidney Foundation of Ohio is a great partner with us that helps us in times of trouble. And Kim will speak about some of those resources, but a great resource for us. The Ohio Renal Association, another group that will have information on all of the dialysis units in Ohio. We have FMC, Fresenius Medical Care, DaVita, and CDC all located in Ohio, and each one of those companies will support each other or, you know, have an individual plan in each other. And then, again, we have an internal disaster preparedness plan. Some symptoms and questions to ask the patient. You want to ask them how they're feeling. See if they have any allergies. See what kind of medications they take, because they may not have brought that medication with them. So how do we, and that's where our friends at the Kidney Foundation of Ohio can help, especially with some emergency funding to get patients maybe a 5 or 10 day supply of meds. It's important to know when their last dialysis treatment was if they are having no symptoms. So if I'm talking and I look symptom-free, you want to know when that was, because within 3 to 4 days, even without treatment, if I'm a very stable dialysis patient, I'm going to have problems. So I'm going to need to get in there. The other thing is trying to, who is your doctor? And that may help you determine whether they're going to the university system or the Cleveland Clinic system. I think we're very fortunate here in Ohio to have two major providers, or to our Parma or to our Metro Health. It is nice and very beneficial to the patient to go to the place that knows them. Not that if they don't go to the place, hospital that knows them, they can't treat them. It is just better for them because they have records, they have their treatment on file. It is a little nicer for the patient. A lot of things that we find that we need is transportation. And I can remember in the blackout in 2004 when we had the global blackout, I was working for a company called Renal Care Group, which is now Fresenius. Actually, we both were. And one of the problems was we had a unit that was going and the generator broke. We had about 175 patients then that couldn't get treatment, and we weren't sure how long the brownout was going to last and how long they were going to be without treatment. And again, it was our obligation to get those patients to another unit. One of the things that we looked at, because we had other units in the area that were running fine, so we knew internally we could accommodate most of those patients. The big problem was, how are they going to get there? Many dialysis patients cannot drive. Many of them rely on either public transportation or some kind of county-based transportation to get to and from dialysis. So we spent a lot of time working with the dialysis transport providers, and those kind of things, coming up with a transportation plan, should we have needed it, to get those patients from, say, a Cleveland Clinic East, which was on Fairhill, to maybe a North Randall unit, or maybe in Solon, or maybe up in Willoughby, where we had units that were up and running. So those are some of the things, transportation, kind of think in the back of your mind, I'm going to need some way to get this patient to dialysis. A lot of the medical transportation companies, Physicians Ambulance, just to name one, really did work with us in that scenario to come forward and say, you know, we'll take the patients anywhere they need to go. We'll figure it out.
Right. As a county, it's important to know who those medical transport companies are, you know, so that in times of disaster where dialysis units don't have power, or there's more of a global disaster, that kind of thing, you need to know who those transportation companies are that you can rely on and say, you know what, we've got a contingency plan in this county. We know which providers are going to be able to transport our patients from skilled nursing facilities, from homes, from wherever, to make sure that they're getting those dialysis treatments.
Dialysis patients do have highly specialized equipment. For the hemodialysis patients, we, as the dialysis provider, house all of that equipment. So it's machines, it's lines, it's dressings, it's bandages, and those are all right inside our unit. One of the things that, from a county perspective, it may be a good exercise to know which dialysis units in the county have generators, because when we just had Hurricane Sandy, we were able to keep patients at our east location because we did have a generator. So even though the power was out all around us, we were able to keep going. So that's a good thing to know from the county, and any of the providers will give you that information.
Essentially, we can't, when it comes to dialysis, we can't do anything without power. There's no power. We can't do anything at all. So we have to have facilities that have generators. We have to identify, in times of disaster, what's our disaster recovery plan if for some strange reason all of our dialysis units are out of power, we can't get the generators going or anything, or who does have the generators? Mm-hmm. Where can we get these patients triaged to?
Which leads us to our next big issue, the second component of what we have to be able to treat patients on a hemo setting. Let me just go back into the emergency equipment. For patients on peritoneal dialysis, their equipment burden is much less. They may have a machine at home that they hook themselves up to at night, but if they don't have that machine, we have equipment. Hospitals will have equipment. dialysis units will be able to provide them with equipment that really essentially looks like an IV bag. It looks like two IV bags hooked together that will go into the patient. And so they are much easier to manage and to get their treatment in times of crisis than the hemodialysis patients.
So if you don't have power,
yes,
can you switch these people to the peritoneal dialysis on pill, or doesn't that work for them?
You can't. I mean, some people, because first of all, they have to have a surgery because they have to have a catheter in their stomach, which most patients don't have. Secondly, there has to be training to do that. So we're going to make the assumption that any kind of a power outage, even if it was something broad spread or global like Hurricane Katrina, that was a finite situation. Within a period of 7 days, every single one of the dialysis patients in Hurricane Katrina were located and had a new temporary permanent place to dialyze. So we couldn't get accesses into those patients in 7 days. And there are a lot of medical reasons. Anyone that's had abdominal surgeries, anyone that has some cancerous things going on, there are some things that prevent people from doing that form of dialysis. So for some people, yes, you could do that on the long term if they said, gosh, I live 100 miles from the nearest dialysis unit. I'm not driving that until my unit is fixed. That would be someone they would probably look at a modality change for, but for the majority of the patients, probably not. So water is the other key component that we need to have. And the most horrifying words in the dialysis unit at 4 in the morning, which is when most of our patient care technicians go there to get things started, is the call that you get that says, we've had a water main break and we don't have water, because there is nothing you can do. You are just done. So in those situations, you are looking for another place for your dialysis unit.
Right. There has to be some kind of contingency plan, even if oftentimes, because this happens in the wintertime in Cleveland, Ohio, often you'll watch the news and they'll say, well, there's a water main break on West 130th. That's a problem for the Fresenius Brook Park unit. You know, there's a water main break just because they have, that particular unit has water. A water main break means there's a breach in the water system, which means that water is now getting dirty. And even though we clean and filter that water, that can really put one of our systems down in a big hurry. If it's doing too much extra work for that water, it can clog filters, it can stop the water system from working. We have to, if there's boil alerts out there, we need to know that right away. Because oftentimes what happens is the water company then puts additives in the water to help clean that up, straighten the water back up so that it's usable water. That's a problem for us. Because taking those additives out and making sure that that water is clean enough to use for dialysis is extremely important.
We have a very good relationship in the industry with the water companies in each county. We send them an emergency letter every year to let them know, hey, we're here. These are the patients that we're taking care of. And we are on an emergency notification system from them that, like he said, if they add more chlorine in the water, which they do a lot in the summer, if for whatever reason they change what the chemicals they put in the water to keep it clean, we need to know about that. And as an industry, we do have a very good rapport with the water companies. They get it because we actually care what's in their waters and nobody else really does, so they actually kind of like us. So everybody's like, yeah, it's water, whatever. We care. We want to know what's in there. Dialysis personnel, it would be important during times of disaster to identify dialysis-trained personnel who could assist in identification and triage. And I know in Hurricane Katrina in Ohio, we sent a contingency down to that area to work in the shelters, patient care technicians and nurses to help identify those patients and work through some of those problems. We also sent care technicians because not only in Hurricane Katrina were our dialysis patients affected, but our dialysis staff was affected as well in that they had nothing. Nurses, patient care techs, social workers, they did not have any where they were in the shelter themselves, coming to work wasn't their priority. They were still looking for their family members. So we will send in national companies, and we will send people to those areas to help take care and identify those. We cannot just pull someone off the street who says, gosh, I understand there's a natural disaster. I want to help here in the dialysis unit. We will utilize you in the dialysis unit, but you will not be doing the dialysis treatment. That is a very specific orientation, certification process that they are very highly trained individuals that work there. We do have guidelines set forth by the Ohio Board of Nursing for both our RNs, LPNs, and our dialysis technicians, as well as the state of Ohio, and CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, which is our primary payer source, also has a list of guidelines that they say a caregiver has to meet prior to taking care of a dialysis patient. For instance, an RN that is out of school, a new graduate, so she or he has just finished school, and they do not have a year's worth of training, they really cannot work by themselves in a dialysis unit as the charge nurse. So the CMS guidelines, which we call the conditions of coverage, ensure that we have people who are very well qualified and trained to take care of this population of patients. So the bottom line is the dialysis patients have to get treatment somewhere. If the patient has a catheter, they will require some kind of a qualified person to help prevent that from getting infected. External environmental considerations are important, so water and power. We can work around almost anything else, but if we don't have power or water, we can't treat patients. Each center will have an individualized plan, as well as each company will have a more global plan, and we work with the renal network to look at plans for all companies, all patients. We actually put the renal network number there. They are wonderful people to work with, and we utilize them a lot in the course of day-to-day treatment. And that is really all we have formally. So questions? I mean, we are here for as long as you need for questions.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Kim McFarlane, and I'm from the Kidney Foundation of Ohio, and we work very closely with the Centers for Dialysis Care, as well as the other providers in the area. We are a locally based nonprofit that focuses on helping patients, family members, and the community, and supporting them mainly through financial assistance in times of need, and then also through education. So there is a pamphlet that each of you are welcome to take. I put them out on the table, so you're welcome to pick one up as you're leaving, and if you need extras, please let me know. I do have some. But we have helped in times of disasters on several occasions. With Hurricane Sandy, I know with CDC, there was a unit where patients had to be transported to another dialysis center for their care, and many of those patients had to drive themselves or rely on others to transport them and didn't have the money to pay for that transportation. So we were able to provide gas gift cards, provide emergency funding to pay those transportation providers, as Tracy spoke of. So we've also stepped in to provide those emergency medications in times of disaster. We work with a specialty pharmacy in the Cleveland area that has the contact information for the patients, for the dialysis units, and can deliver the medications directly to the patients wherever they are. So we have some plans in place where if there are issues, if there are disasters, we are able to step in and provide that financial support which so many people need. But on an ongoing basis, we do have financial aid for medication, transportation, and emergency needs that patients may have. We also do education for healthcare professionals. We have a renal symposium every September. So if any of you are in the healthcare field and interested in CE credits and ongoing healthcare education, there is information about that in our pamphlet as well.
Initially, in the Justice Center, anytime someone was dialysis was sentenced,
right,
they wouldn't send them to Lorain. They would move them right to the Fraser Hospital.
Right.
Hospital. Is it still that way around Columbus, or are there different? Can they give them services in different places now?
Or are you speaking all patients, or just incarcerated patients?
Incarcerated places. Is there just one facility specified, or is it decentralized?
I think it depends, and I think in the Columbus area, if I remember correctly, in the Columbus area, it's still centralized for the most part. Now, there are other areas of the country where incarcerated patients can be transported to our facilities. We actually have that situation right now, and sometimes local communities or counties, the county doesn't have that many incarcerated dialysis patients at any given time. So, and they may not hang on to those incarcerated patients for very long. So, in the interim, while they have them, they contract with a company like us, and we have the sheriff's department bring the patient over. We do dialysis, and then bring them back.
With, I believe, Ashland County, do you have any questions on Ashland?
In the first page here, meeting the patient's needs, the fluid intake, we have a contaminated water supply. Will alcoholic beverages work?
You know what? I can tell you our dialysis patients and many of my college friends will say alcoholic beverages do in fact work. However, keep in mind that an alcoholic beverage is going to dehydrate more. So what that is going to cause is the patient to become more and more thirsty. They may not notice it because they passed out, but they are.
But it could suffice for a supply of fluid if that's the only alternative.
Again, as a nurse, I can't support that.
Right. It's not recommended.
You just let them go without fluid.
I think, again, I don't have any studies to back me up, but I have never heard of that. Because if you can, I'm hoping that if you can find a bottle of alcohol, you could find a bottle of water somewhere.
And what type of capacity do the dialysis centers have? You know, a hospital has, let's say, a spare capacity, maybe 15% beds available at a given time or something like that. I mean, what type of capacity do dialysis centers have? Because we're in a rural area,
mm-hmm.
And if we're locked in, then I mean, how many more patients does a center handle?
Each center is going to have a number of chairs that they're licensed to take care of. So let's just say, for example, in each center is going to need about 4 hours a night for the water system to do what is regenerated. So what usually happens in those situations where your demand may exceed your number of chairs is that the dialysis providers will do an assessment on every patient, both the patients that are in your unit as well as the patients that are not in your unit. And the philosophy is some dialysis is better than none. So if someone is normally scheduled for a four-hour dialysis treatment, they may, for a small period of time, get 3 hours. So we can actually put more people in. What else happens is usually a lot of dialysis units are open what we call first and second shift. So they may open up at 5 in the morning, 5 to 6 in the morning, and they may be done at 3 in the afternoon. What would happen in that situation is that they would add what we call shifts on. So we would have a group of patients that dialyze from like 3 and keep it open all the way to maybe 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. So we will figure out a way to get every patient that needs dialysis at least some dialysis. And that gives us just a little bit of a window to figure out a more permanent plan in a situation where, say, the dialysis center burnt down or, you know, you needed to find another place for a large number of people for long term. So there would be probably a short-term plan, and then a more permanent long-term plan, all involving a physician, the nurse, the social worker, a renal dietitian. There would be a team approach to looking at that.
How closely do you work with the Red Cross and Mass Sheltering?
From a dialysis perspective, in Ohio, we don't work hand-in-hand with them. I can tell you in a lot of those hurricane situations, or if there is a predicted or an anticipated disaster, the dialysis company and places like the Red Cross, the Salvation Army, those kind of organizations will meet prior to that and have some kind of an organized plan. In our southern units, when I worked for a national company, the dialysis industry and, for instance, the Red Cross and some of the power companies and some of the generator companies, they had a regular quarterly meeting. We don't have that scope of disaster usually in Ohio, but it's not a bad idea to get started getting involved in it. And I will tell you, after we had our situation in Fort Wayne where we actually closed down the highways, the dialysis companies and it was the board of the county board of health did start having quarterly meetings just to make sure everybody was on the same page, so we were able to take care of patients in a more systematic fashion.
How many gallons of water does it take to treat a patient for a standard dialysis treatment?
I'm sure that we could calculate that. It's fairly difficult to say that it takes, you know, 10 gallons or 20 gallons. You know, generally speaking, our dialysis units, depending on the size and the volume of stations that are at those dialysis units, we'll have holding tanks that are 300 gallons large sometimes. You know, it takes a lot of water. But it would be difficult to say that I can dialyze a patient on 3 gallons of water. You could back it. You could do the math and back into it, but the water in a dialysis unit never stops running. So the water systems run 24 hours a day. As Tracy was saying before, dialysis units generally run X number of shifts. We can only run about 4 standard shifts in a day, which are generally speaking 4 to 5 hours. So that last 4 hours of the day, the water systems need time to regenerate. We have to backwash our carbons, we have to get the water prepared again and make sure that our rejection rates are good and that the water is pure. We use almost 100% purified water to do a dialysis treatment. So if water sits for any more than a couple minutes, bacteria starts to grow in it even after we've treated the water. So in the situation of a dialysis unit, with that water running constantly through one main loop all the time, There's water constantly touching the patients.
When I worked in the Akron market, I worked in a 15-station unit, and we saw 75 patients. We saw 3 shifts of patients or 45 patients on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and 2 shifts of patients or 30 patients on Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. We used per day about 60,000 gallons of water. It's a lot.
Right. Throughout the course of the day, you know, our holding tanks, you know, they drain so far and then they keep regenerating. That thing fills up, empties and fills up, you know, a few hundred times in a day.
So, and I don't remember the statistic, but I was at a session where they compared the amount of water exposure that the normal person just drinking and cooking and even doing summer activities like swimming, the gallons of water in a year that a normal person would have versus the gallons of water a year that a dialysis patient comes into contact with. And it was just a staggering amount. And I don't have that number, but it is eye-opening the amount of water that our dialysis patients come in contact with on a daily basis.
Right. Just to give you an idea of, you know, the volume of water that could be used in a large unit, as Tracy's saying, a 75-patient unit, you use 60,000 gallons of water. It's kind of roughly the size of go to the YMCA and see a swimming pool, an indoor swimming pool that holds about 60,000 gallons. So that's how much water we could use in a day, about a swimming pool's worth.
Can well water be used for dialysis without softening, or does it have to be softened?
It'll be softened.
It has to be, right.
We still use fluoride, like
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
What is your power need in terms of even running one station?
Well, I don't know. But again, I'm sure
we have to have it.
Right. At the end of the day, gotta have power. It's a good question. You know, can I have a group of, you know, people get on exercise bikes and generate enough power for a dialysis treatment? Probably not. You know, it's a good question. I'm sure that you could back into the number and do the math on it, but I don't know that off the top of my head.
Well, and those are some of the calculations that when we're looking at generator sizes, that the folks that work with those generators and the electrical engineers that work in that industry, they are able to answer that. We just don't have that information.
Let's move on to Ashtabula County, and then if we still have time, we'll come back to Ashland. Ashtabula, do you have questions?
No, we don't have any, Karen. Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to open it up to Cuyahoga County. Mary?
So do I understand that you have a portable unit? Do you have a portable unit? A mobile unit, I should call it.
Can you sort of repeat the question, please?
She's asking if we have a mobile unit. The easy answer is no. We don't. The patients that dialyze at home have more mobility and being able to take their supplies.
For HD. So you can't do it. You have to be able to go to one of the sites.
Yes. Yes.
Can I ask you a couple questions about the demography of the hemodialysis patients?
Sure.
Now, what's the balance of over 65, under 65?
There is a larger balance of patients at 60 and over, a much larger, much larger patient population at that stage. So, you know, 70% of our patients are probably over 60 years old.
What is the average length of use of being on hemodialysis? In other words, how long do those patients survive on hemodialysis? Are we talking years?
We are talking years.
Yeah.
We've had patients that, if a patient is compliant and takes care of themselves, we have had patients in my career that have hit the 25, 30, 35-year mark. We've also had patients that have lasted less than a year. It's really dependent on what their medical state is. But if you've got a young person who has what we call polycystic kidney disease, where it's a genetic condition, their heart is good, their blood pressure is good, they're very compliant. We, of course, want to get those people transplanted. We don't want to keep them on dialysis forever, but if that's a choice they make, they could stay on for years.
So we could have patients with very short spans and not a lot of experience and others that are
yes.
incredibly experienced
yes. and know yes. And you will also see patients who are very involved in their care, so they will know who their doctor is, when they're left, how much fluid they took off, what their dry weight is, what happens if they go 10 minutes without dialysis, and then you'll have patients that, yeah, I go somewhere three times a week. It may be dialysis. So you'll have varying degrees of patient involvement as well.
And lifespan depends greatly on your compliance in terms of prescription treatment time. So if you're a dialysis patient and your prescription treatment time is 4 hours a time, three times a week, but you want to, you have stuff to do, you shorten your dialysis treatment by a half hour every time, you will shave years off your lifespan. So it's important for patients to stay on that prescribed treatment time.
If you know anyone on dialysis, encourage them to stay. More is better.
You have a question?
I thought I heard you say that patients can survive with 5% of kidney function.
Yes.
At what point do patients go on dialysis?
Okay. Good question. First of all, and this is, the question is, we had talked about kidney function. Normal people can survive with about 5% of their kidney function. The question was, at what point do they go on dialysis, and at what point do, and once they're on dialysis, do the kidneys keep functioning? Is that, okay. First of all, for kidney function, there is, and I'm going to try to do this justice, and this is where I wish our medical director who spews these statistics off of the top of his head. So I'm going to try not to make Dr. Peter DiOrio cringe and have him not know why. But the way that we check kidney function is a glomerular filtration rate, or a GFR. And we look at that number to determine how well the kidneys are functioning. And what we see a lot is that many people that start dialysis don't make urine. And it's very hard for patients because they believe if they're making urine that they shouldn't go on dialysis. And unfortunately, what we tell them, it's not the quantity of urine you're making, it's the quality of urine. So there is a certain number, which I do not know off the top of my head, which Peter is twitching right now, that when they get to this glomerular filtration rate or this GFR, we will actually have them start dialysis. Now, when that happens, and really, while we look at that number, the big determinant of starting someone on dialysis is when they start feeling bad. And patients will get very kind of universal symptoms. They'll get what's called, it's a gray look, and they'll get almost like a frosty pallor to their skin. We call it a uremic frost. It's where they're not pulling out enough of the toxins. People will get nauseated. That's one of the big things where they can't keep anything down. They throw up everything. That's because their waste is getting too high. So those are big ones. They have trouble breathing. They just feel bad. A lot of mild confusion. So you can have a conversation with them, and then all of a sudden out of nowhere will come something like, oh, my gosh, where is that? And families usually notice that before we do. Because if we're having a conversation and say, who are you, where are you, what's the date, they're able to answer all of those questions. It's like that subtle confusion that someone who's really close knows. So you look at that rate when it gets to a certain point, and then their symptoms, and that's when the determination is made to start dialysis. Now, because, like I said, everybody here, if we were all on dialysis and we all drank fluid, we would all react differently. Many patients respond to dialysis differently and kidneys shut down differently. So, yes, the short answer is many patients that we've started on dialysis do have what's called residual renal function. So they will still make urine, and those patients typically can go longer in between dialysis, so they're still making some urine. They may be able to go 3 days or 4 days in between dialysis where someone with complete and total shutdown who's been on dialysis for a while, they're not going to be able to make it. And it's a very hard concept for patients because patients are making urine. They should not have to do this. So it becomes very difficult to try to explain it from the healthcare side as this is why you have to go on.
Right. And your kidneys balance out a great deal of body systemic functions. And so even though your kidneys, you may be making urine still, and there's some residual renal function, it's not enough to keep you a healthy individual. Dialysis or kidney disease is classified in stages, just like cancer is classified in stages. So end-stage renal disease is stage 5. So when you're in end-stage renal disease, the chances of regaining any kidney function is about 0. Now there are other reasons to end up on dialysis, but they're a little bit more rare. Trauma, you end up on dialysis, but that oftentimes, the majority of the time, you're going to regain your kidney function unless it was so traumatic that your kidney's taken out or something like that. Polycystic kidney disease could likely put you or will eventually put you on dialysis as well, but if you're in polycystic kidney disease, your kidneys will have completely shut down at some point in life.
There's a lot. We as an industry are getting a lot better at managing those pre-ESRD phases because the goal, believe it or not, is to keep people off dialysis and keep them not having dialysis as long as possible. And in my 25 years of nursing, we are able to see patients stayed off of dialysis with better medication management, better education, earlier identification. And I know one of the things that our friends at the Kidney Foundation does is do a lot of work with early identification. So if you are having high blood pressure symptoms in your 20s, get it taken care of. So when you're in your 40s, you are not a dialysis patient, and we do a lot of work to keep them off of dialysis because it is a really difficult thing in life. It really becomes a major factor in your life. It's 3 times a week. You're there usually 5 to 6 hours at a time. By the time you get there, wait to get called in, have 4 hours on the treatment, get your treatment ended, get checked out, wait for your ride. It is a part-time job. So our goal is to make that time that they're with us as pleasant as possible and make them feel as good as they can in between those times. That's what we look at as our success stories, is when someone comes in and all of a sudden they're like, gosh, I start feeling better. I can do things on my off days now. That's when we're doing what we should be doing.
Right. And that's, and again, you know, as an industry, we're trying to do a lot of that pre-ESRD education, you know, as much as we can. There are a lot of reasons you end up on dialysis, but mismanagement of diabetes is one of the most significant.
Other questions?
Yeah, one more.
I've been on the side of nursing that frequently we would see patients coming in with clotted shunts.
Yep.
And or clotted displaced catheters.
Sure.
In the dialysis area, what are you able to do for the patient in, you know, to get something that works?
Well, that's a wonderful question.
We
would love to answer. It's a great question.
First of all, we have to do a lot of patient education. And when we see accesses that are, let me go even back. If they have that catheter in their chest, we want that out. We don't want them to have that. That is a portal for infection, and it's a tough sell for a dialysis patient. They're coming in with this thing that's in their neck that's already there, and we're just screwing up two lines as opposed to their neighbor who's getting stuck with two needles 3 times a week. So it's a hard sell for us, except that their neighbor's going to last for maybe 25 years on dialysis. Their catheter is not going to get them through that. They are going to get an infection, and they are most likely going to die because of it. So we want to get the catheters out. The second thing with the accesses, the first thing we've got to do is identify good qualified surgeons that put them in. And we're working, again, as an industry with our surgical partners to get that happen. The second thing we're doing as a unit is try to identify when that catheter or when that access starts becoming sluggish. At the very beginning of that, when can I as a nurse intervene so that doesn't totally clot up? Because once the access is totally clotted off, it becomes much more difficult to get that working again as opposed to I've just got some clots or some stenosis forming. Third is that we have an access center at CDC, so we are able to offer to our patients and to our competitors' patients same-day service. So if Jamie comes in and says, you know, my access isn't working, I don't know what happened, all of a sudden I'm not feeling, we call it feeling a thrill, but it's not buzzing, or the patient care technicians fix that access and there's clots and no blood coming out, we can get them into that access center in the same day so that they don't miss treatment and get them back into one of our units to treat. We do a lot of education, though. We had, in one of my former jobs, we had this patient that there was no reason this access, it was clotted all the time. And it was a healthy person otherwise. They kept doing the venograms. They're like, no, it's not narrowing. Well, it's because they were doing lumbar. They were working with lumbar, and he was holding. It was in his left hand, and he was right-handed. So he was putting lumbar as he using his arm as like a, and he was clotting it right off. So there's a lot of education that we can do, carrying bags or groceries on that arm. Things like that. So we try to do a lot of education. And we as an industry, as well as our partners, need to get a lot better at that.
Right.
That's one of the things that as we move forward in the industry, not just CDC, but all of our partners are looking at more education for patients.
Right.
Because an educated, well-informed patient is usually a much healthier patient.
And when we talked earlier before about length of people on their dialysis treatment and why it's so important for them to get those dialysis treatments, that's all good quality dialysis treatment as well. So we monitor the access flow. We want to see blood flow rates through that access while they're on dialysis, and we measure that to see if the function's decreasing. If it's decreasing 3 months in a row, then it's time to refer them down to our access center, have them do a declot, angioplasty, a catheter exchange, whatever the case might be, because we want to keep the patients out of the hospital as well. Because they can't come to, if they don't come to us and we can't get them in and out in the same day, they're going to end up in the hospital, be in the hospital 3 or 4 days, miss a bunch of dialysis treatments. So our goal is to keep them out of the hospital and on dialysis.
Yeah.
Is the
Well, and keep in mind, and again, every patient is going to react a little differently to dialysis. For me personally, if someone told me I had to sit in a chair for 4 hours and have limited movement, I mean, you can move, but you're still in a chair, that would make me very, it would make me tense. So it's not an uncomfortable process. Some people, it's not like they feel pain other than the initial stick. But the other side of that is, keep in mind that their body, two-thirds or one-third of their blood at any given time is outside of their body being clean. So there is that washed-out feeling. And when patients say that I feel washed out and I feel I'm just exhausted the next day, those are the kind of things that's the kind of feedback that we need to know from a dialysis center, because we could maybe do some changes on our prescription or on our time or the way we take fluid off so that they don't feel that. Our goal with dialysis is giving them optimal care so that they don't have that feeling. And in the beginning, it's like anything. It's a trial and error until you find the prescription that actually works and they feel good. We get a lot of people saying that. And some people are just exhausted. Our elderly patients, it is just exhausting to be there. And again, then you're looking at waiting in the lobby for their ride to pick them up and then a trip home. It is a whole day affair. So for any nurses or healthcare professionals in the room, if you are seeing dialysis patients that are saying that, I just don't feel good, from a dialysis provider side, we would love to know that bit, especially extended care facilities, because when we ask the patient the next day, oh, how did you do after dialysis? Oh, I did fine. You know, those are that's the information that allows us to treat them better.
Can we go to Medina County now? Do you have any questions?
We do have one. One moment.
I consider dialysis machines to be sort of like life-sustaining equipment, and I was kind of surprised to find out that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the Ohio Revised Code does not require dialysis equipment to be put on generators. Is that right?
That is correct. She asked if she was quite surprised because dialysis is a life-sustaining treatment, but the Ohio Revised Code does not require dialysis units to have generators. And you're right. The Ohio Revised Code or the CMS conditions of coverage don't, but what they do require is that every dialysis company have a plan for dialyzing all of their patients. So while I may not have a generator in my 10-station unit that's maybe located in a nursing home or in a strip mall or somewhere else, I do have a plan as a dialysis company that I can take those patients to get them treated. And I think that's the compromise, because from an EPA standpoint, there's a lot of regulations and requirements that come with generators and using diesel and those checks and testing them on a weekly basis that a small company or they wouldn't be able to maintain that.
Right. We're required to have documentation, yearly updated documentation about what our contingency plan is to treat our dialysis patients, but about a third of our units do have generators. So.
And I think you'll find that in most companies, probably I would say, a quarter to a third of them geographically located have generators. Generally speaking, they're in the bigger units. Rurally, when we're looking at dialysis units out west where there's maybe a dialysis unit and then the next one is 250 miles away, I think you'll see a whole different plan for those companies that have generators? Because I think because we're so consolidated in the Ohio area, Columbus, Akron, Cincinnati, we have ways to get our patients dialysis. Are there any other questions?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, are patients, do they choose the dialysis centers or is it referred by a physician? And are the centers, like, certified and regulated?
Ultimately, it's the patient's choice.
Let me just repeat the question for the those of you on the phone. The question was, do patients get to choose dialysis centers? Are they referred by physicians? And are the dialysis centers certified? Was that so?
Right. The, we are required to maintain a licensure, a state licensure, and also a federal licensure. So we are surveyed by the state of Ohio for both state and federal on a regular basis for licensure and certification. So we are required by law to be certified, yes. And ultimately, yes, it is the patient's choice in terms of a dialysis center. Physicians will oftentimes say, well, I generally go to this dialysis unit and you're my patient. If the patient wants to stay with that physician, then they kind of tend to go towards that unit. But if you're closer to this unit over there and you want to go, then, you know, we have 82 physicians that refer into our organization. So we have some physicians of one patient because that's closer to the patient's house, our unit, and that's where they like to go. And oftentimes, once patients are on dialysis in a particular dialysis unit, they start meeting their friends, they're there 3 days a week, and then they tend to want to stay there and that kind of thing. So
it's quite a social network once they're in there. It is, and from a dialysis care provider side, you know, they've got their own little, because they're in a room, you know, maybe this size, and just imagine chairs all along the wall with maybe a nursing station in the middle. And so if I'm sitting by Jamie and then all of a sudden some nurse moves Jamie's chair, I take that very personally.
Right.
So there is a lot of work that goes into keeping them with their social network and those pieces. They become very much like a little family. And they care about one each other, and they look out for one another. The families know one another. It is tough. And once they get in a dialysis center, unless there's some kind of problem or conflict, they will stay at the center. That's where they feel comfortable. They feel safe. So even if their physician would say, oh, you know, I'm going to another center, I'm opening a new center, do you want to come? A lot of times we find patients that say, I'm just going to stay where I am.
Do you ever run like codes on patients?
Yes.
Code them up?
We do. Sudden cardiac death is probably one of the leading causes, is one of the main complication on dialysis. And there are several reasons that can happen. A lot of times, again, back to don't want to harp on the non-compliance, but someone that comes in that's perhaps missed fluid or missed dialysis for a week, majorly fluid overload, we put them on, we start pulling fluid off. Even if we do it slowly, their cardiac status just can't take it and they cardiac arrest. So all of the dialysis technicians and nurses are trained in CPR, trained. We call 911 and obviously get them out of there as soon as possible. I can tell you when an arrest happens at a dialysis center, it is very emotional and disturbing, not just for the patient or the family of the patient that may be in the waiting room, but it's very distressful for the staff because they have been taking care of that patient for maybe 10 or 15 years, and it's extremely distressing to the patient because they can watch it. And while we try to put screens up to protect patients, they know what's going on back there. And this is their friend, and they get a glimpse of their own mortality. So we do a lot of work after that happens when the patient is taken out of the unit. We do a lot of work going chair side to chair side. Are you okay? Do you want to talk? Can I talk to you? We have social workers, licensed social workers on staff that do a lot of that work, and nurses and technicians, because it is a very hard thing to see.
Well, right, and we're continuously monitoring patients' vital signs, blood pressure, heart rate, access flow throughout the whole entire treatment.
One of the things that we can do is move to a short discussion about peritoneal dialysis, if that just so that in case you run into somebody who is on peritoneal dialysis, you'll have a good idea. Kim, do you have any suggestions about how, what percentage of renal failure patients are on peritoneal versus hemodialysis?
I can answer that. Company-wide, industry-wide, it's less than 10% of the population is on peritoneal dialysis. One of the strategic goals of all companies, and this is dependent, regardless of whether you are a Fresenius or a DaVita or an FMC or Fresenius, is to encourage more patients to get on peritoneal. It is, you have to have a physician champion within an institution that supports and encourages peritoneal, and for whatever reason, the majority of nephrologists practicing in the United States just have a preference for hemo. And we as industry, we're trying to change that, because I can tell you, if I was on dialysis, because I'm a healthcare provider, if I would do peritoneal. I'm able to do it on my own. Home hemo is an option, although you have to have a partner, and I know once my husband falls asleep and I started bleeding, I would be dead, because he would never, ever hear that. So, well, he would be more than happy to give it the college try. I would die. But peritoneal, I can do on my own. I can travel. I can plan my own schedule. So it is something as an industry that we're trying to increase. But for our company, it's about 4%, and that's not unusual industry-wide.
And you also find there's fewer patients because eventually, over time, your peritoneal cavity can't filter the blood anymore. So eventually, at some point, many of the patients will end up on hemodialysis anyway. But it's much better to start on peritoneal dialysis, stay on that treatment therapy for as long as you possibly can before you get to a point where you have to be on hemo.
And this is where your residual renal function, if you're on peritoneal dialysis with some residual renal function, you have a really good quality of life. You feel good. Your diet is liberalized. It is a really... it's a really good thing.
This is Karen Seidman, and I actually worked in a PD unit for a year about 20 years ago, but I think things haven't changed that much.
Right.
Usually there's a surgical insertion of a soft tube or a catheter into the peritoneal cavity. Dialysis solution is instilled into the peritoneal cavity where it dwells, and that's where by osmosis you get rid of extra fluid, waste products, and minerals. And then after several hours, you drain that solution out, and you put another bag of fluid in. Usually it's anywhere from about a liter and a half of fluid to about 3 liters of fluid. And so
I would be a 3-liter person. She would be a 1.5 to 2-liter person based on size. So.
And correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of times if it's a child who's in failure, the preference is to go with peritoneal dialysis.
She is correct. For pediatrics, there's a huge shift on the pediatric population. The majority of those, and I've never worked peds dialysis, so I don't have statistics, but they absolutely go on peritoneal. And the reason for that is, number one, it's safer. It lets the parents get involved. Their peritoneum is young and fresh and still very much able to exchange the water and the fluid. And the other goal for pediatric dialysis is to get them stabilized so they can get a transplant, because many times a parent or a family member, the goal is to get them through to get transplanted. But, yes, that's what we see as well, or my nursing experience has been.
Pediatric dialysis is a completely different animal altogether. You will not find chronic dialysis units that are doing both, you know, adult hemodialysis and pediatrics at the same time. It's not intermixed at all. They're very separate.
There are also, if you get somebody into your shelter that's on peritoneal dialysis, they may do it two different ways. One is called CAPD, and that's continuous ambulatory peritoneal dialysis, and that's where usually 3 or 4 times a day they're doing what I described originally, which is putting fluid in their peritoneal cavity, and then after it sits there for a while, then draining it out and repeating that process again 3 or 4 times a day. The other thing is using a cycler, and because a cycler needs power to run in an emergency, that doesn't work real well.
Mm-hmm.
But most people who are on cyclers use the cycler at night, so they hook it up, they hang all the bags, thread all the tubing through the cycler, and it does this overnight, basically. And then you dump out all that fluid out of the bags in the morning and probably instill some fluid during the day. They go about their business and then repeat the same thing day after day. So those people that are on the cycler during an emergency, if there's no power, the instructions are to go back. They have been trained so that they should be able to do the ambulatory peritoneal dialysis.
Can I interject?
Yep.
The nice thing about CAPD is there are two companies that supply products for our CAPD. One of them is Fresenius Medical. The other is Baxter. They are only going to be on a Fresenius or a Baxter setup. And much like the dialysis unit will find that patient, the Baxter supply company will find that patient to make sure that they have the supplies they need, they have a place to do their dialysis. So our PD patients are kind of getting it from two angles, the dialysis center, the PD unit where the nurses work, what you would have called, as well as the dialysis supply company. And they are amazing at the lengths they go to get patients their supplies and even find place patients. I mean, we have had in my career, and I did start out as a PD nurse back in the day, I think 20 years ago, we had a person who started out in a home and then just lived in his car for a while. And we're like, oh, my God, this will never work. And you know what? We made it work. We had his supplies delivered to his mother's garage, and he kind of went off and around as he did his business and whatever, probably up to no good, but, you know, whatever he did. And he would come back once a week or so and pick it up and come for his clinic test. So they are a very resilient and very creative group of people. I worry less about our PD patients than I do about our hemo patients, because they will be fine. They will make it happen.
If you have somebody on PD who comes into your shelter, if they have the bags of solution with them and the tubing with them and have a place to do it, they'll probably use a mask, they'll wash their hands. They probably need a room by themselves. If you're in a school, to put them in a classroom would probably, especially during an exchange, probably an ideal situation. So they would know what they need. The bags, as I mentioned, they use, these bags are heavy. They're not going to be able to carry like a week's worth of bags with them.
Yeah.
The boxes are heavy. They know what their routine is, and they should be able to tell you. The next slide is an illustration that shows how they actually put the tube in. And I
should have put pictures there. Yeah,
Tracy, I don't know if your experience was as mine was, but one of my jobs was to go into surgery when they had surgery and run, make sure the fluid
yep.
ran in and came back out before they sewed everything up.
That is a great, and let me just say the institution you worked at, kudos to them for letting a nurse do that. Our surgeons did it. I say.
And then this last slide is just sort of an illustration of sort of what happens. And, yes, they do it at home. They do it at work. They do it wherever. and they, you know, it's a pretty mobile kind of thing. So in one way, this is an easier group to deal with during a power outage or something like that.
But in a shelter, you actually may need to service them more because you're not going to be you may be responsible, again, for providing them a location, not just finding out where they need to go. So while they are independent and they will let you know what you need, it may cause some challenges because you may need to find them a quiet, clean place or those kind of things. So,
and if they're there for any length of time, probably to get supplies in to, they need the fluid bag, they need tubing and things like that. So that could be a challenge as well.
And really, once you find their supplier, if I said you need to deliver at the Cuyahoga County Board of Health, there would be a driver at your door doing that. So, yeah. It's all one tube. Yeah. So you're going to put it up high, gravity put it in, tie it off, clamp it off, let it do what we call dwell, where you're going to walk around with it. It feels full, I would imagine. And then at a certain point, it's a physician prescription, you're going to lay it on the floor. Again, gravity is going to drain it out.
Yes, Ashlyn has a question.
Questions. Just with your recent description here, I'm a nurse and I've worked at a facility with a variety of the peritoneal dialysis, and they did use cyclers with the machines. And so I was kind of curious as to what would be done in the event of a power outage here in the local community in the outlying areas of anybody that would be having a machine at home. Because sometimes these people, they may have caregivers that are able to help them, but at other times when they were in the nursing facility, they were ill and they had maybe an infection or something, the reason they were in there. It's a fairly technical type treatment and care, which would not be able to be handled in a shelter, but you're saying that they do convert to the peritoneal dialysis, the gravitational type flow. One of my questions is, yeah, they do need to be isolated and to be kept in a you know, a private area so they can be clean. And we also, when we had the PD patients there at the skilled facility, we were also directed to turn off any air conditioning, any fans of that type, so that they didn't have any kind of bacteria blowing around in the air. Is that a typical...
So I, basically the question is, one of the last question was about having air conditioners or fans going.
Right.
And that would be during and when you're hooking up the tubing.
Right.
But once everything is a closed system, once the fluid is in and you're not playing with the tubing, then... they can participate in things as they normally would.
And as for the, this is Tracy from CDC. As for the air conditioning and the fan, one of the things that we tell the patients is you certainly don't want that air blowing directly on them. But when a PD patient is doing exchanges at home, they don't turn their central air off. So you want to make sure they're not under a vent. There's not an airstream blowing on that, and that would be heat, warm, or cool air. While they're doing that exchange. But does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I had one other question, and it's related to maybe a larger shelter in a Katrina-type situation where I was during Katrina. You had mentioned, and this has to do with the Privacy Act, and this is probably a stupid question, I don't know, but you mentioned trying to find and maybe locate your dialysis patients in the event of a disaster at that time. But where does the Privacy Act fall there? Because working with Red Cross, we're instructed not to release information, personal information. And I realize dialysis treatment is, you know, a life-threatening thing that they do need. But in the event... how do we verify who's calling? What would the situation be in a mass sheltering type situation? to release it, or to find that client, would there be a release form that they would sign?
She's asking about the HIPAA and the privacy laws, and what in a shelter situation she's able to release. Say if I, as the healthcare providing, am calling and saying, "Is Jane Smith in your shelter?" The HIPAA, which is the Health Information Protection and Portability Act, was enacted in 2002, which did protect especially hospital-type patients from having their information shared. And one of the main reasons for that act was so that if I was an employer and I called and said, you know, I work at, Honda, could you tell me, is Karen on dialysis? Because if Karen's on dialysis, I'm not going to hire her because I don't want to pay her insurance premium. That's what that law was designed to protect. There are caveats within that law that says that I can share information for healthcare treatment, healthcare billing, and there's one other. Treatment, payment, and operations. So I, as a dialysis provider, am allowed to get that information, and I'm protected by law, and you in the shelter would be protected by law. The difficult part of that is, how do you know on the phone that I am who I say I am? You know, how do you know that I'm calling, I'm Tracy from dialysis, do you have Jane Smith in your unit? I'm not an estranged husband looking. And that's where it becomes difficult. And I will tell you, you're just going to have to use your guts in that. I mean, and I think I would talk to the patient if I were you in the shelter, go back and talk to Jane Smith. I would ask for my number. Gosh, Tracy, let me check. Let me see if she's here. Can I have your number and call you back? I would go talk to the patient. You know, your dialysis unit is calling. Can I release information? I would probably play it that way.
Okay. Thanks. That helps.
Okay. Yeah.
In shelter operations, at the intake, would there be a questionnaire regarding sharing of health information if a person has a special need?
There's a question at shelter operations at intake, would there be a questionnaire? And I've never worked in shelter operations, so I am totally not equipped to answer that.
We actually do have a medical questionnaire for shelter ops.
Okay.
And to whom we can release the information to.
Red Cross does collect some information, and I don't know the answer to that question, but we can check with Red Cross and find out.
I think in emergency situations, truly, as a volunteer or as a healthcare provider or as just someone in the community, we try to do the best we can. And I think I would go with my gut. If it didn't feel right, I wouldn't do it. I don't care who I made angry, but I would work to make sure that I was able to. I wouldn't just shut it down. And we see a lot in healthcare, when we call for information to nursing homes or places like that, they're like, we can't share that with you. It's a HIPAA violation. It's like, no, you don't want to go look in the chart because HIPAA provides, you know, so we as healthcare use HIPAA a lot of ways not to share information. And the law is a good one. It was put in place for the right reasons. We've got to make sure we're using it correctly. Just another side on HIPAA. HIPAA is very difficult on the patients in the unit because we used to, in the old days, when a patient wasn't there, we could tell their little social group, you know, Mr. Smith is in the hospital. And now we really are limited saying those kind of things. So it puts us as the healthcare provider in a very difficult position. And so while we love HIPAA, we also hate it. So it works for us and against us. Do we have any other questions?
Well, on the labor comp, Tri-C gets a course in the anatomy of the arm for their phlebotomy track, but that's different than the full functions of DT. A DT has to move fluid in as well as out of the system.
Well,
how do you get the competencies that you need for the
First of all, it's on-the-job training, but as far as that anatomy of the arm, when you're looking at what you take as a phlebotomy, that's probably normal anatomy of the arm.
Uh-huh.
An internal access is actually created by a fistula. So what a surgeon is going to do is take the end of a very strong artery and the end of a very strong vein and put those together to create this very large, probably, gosh, I would say 2 to 3 centimeters in diameter vein that sticks out of your arm. So it is going to be a hyper vein when you're just looking at it to the naked eye. So with that, and with that, you need to know which way it's going because flow matters. You need to know which side's the arterial side and which side's the venous side, and there are ways you can check that. And the training for that all comes within the dialysis provider's Ohio Board of Nursing approved training program. So that's all on-the-job training, but our training program, much like nursing programs, are approved by, I forget the board that approves those, the Ohio Board of Nursing approves all the dialysis providers' training programs. Make sure it's consistent and accurate and thorough and those kind of things.
In case of emergency, is there a number that you person running the shelter could call to find out how many people in his area are on dialysis?
Yes, and that would be your... The question was, in case of an emergency, could a person in a shelter call a number and find out how many people in the surrounding area are on dialysis? And that's the renal network number. They are going to know that number, and when we had Sandy and we had power outages in Ohio, at Ashtabula County, in Cuyahoga and Ashtabula County, I can assure you the renal network had those files and those numbers pulled for all of those patients, because if there was an issue, they were going to be ready. They would be ready to respond to those needs.
They won't
release the names, but they'll tell you, oh, you have, in your surrounding area, you have 634 dialysis patients. And they will probably be able to tell you within a day or two what dialysis centers are operational and which ones aren't. In that area, you have 3 dialysis centers that are operational, and they're here, here, and here. These 2 are not, and those are the patients that need to deploy. And they will know how many patients are in those centers. We have 66 patients that we need to find alternate plans for. So that's going to be your database that has all of that information. There you go. Yes, the other good service is called Dialysis Finder, and that's what you punch in, Dialysis Finder, and it will show you all of the dialysis units, and you can just pick your radius, 5, 10, 15, 50, 100, and it'll have every single dialysis unit listed, and a phone number and an address.
And it's really easy to do.
And it's very easy to do.
And you know, we are... Again, any questions that you may have, and Karen, you have our email contact, which I am more than comfortable sending out to anyone who needs it. So we've got email contacts. Anything we can help to do, education or support for the community, and I know I speak for Kim as well, we are more than happy to lend any kind of assistance that we need.
We'll be back. Thank you.